Learning and development are strongly founded in social interaction and culture. And the tradition of studying the cultural and social foundations of development and learning is basic long-term in human development. These days, Vygotsky is the flag person leading that movement, though he's been dead a long time. Today we're going to talk about that approach, the sign of social learning approach, especially Vygotsky's contribution to it and work that's derived from Vygotsky's. And we're going to focus on how the person starts in a society and a culture, how social learning theory, classic theory that goes back 100 years, is grounded in that proposition, and how Vygotsky specified in particular some of the social processes that lead to learning and development, and then some of the consequences of this view, in particular how micro-development produces the kind of social collaboration that leads to construction of new knowledge, and how cultural roles and stereotypes lead us to not only know, but also to distort. So those will be the focus for our treatment of the social foundations of learning and diversity in development. This approach is really powerfully grounded in two primary cultures, the United States and the Soviet Union, as it used to be called, now Russia. The approach strongly explains developmental differences and similarities in terms of the social environment, the cultural construction of that environment. And interestingly, it's really linked in both cultures with progressivism, with what we think of as the liberal progressive agenda for society. Vygotsky these days is the leader of this movement, although he actually died in 1934. He became powerfully influential in Russia, then the USSR, during his life, and influenced virtually every important scholar and researcher in Russia after that, his death. So he was either the mentor of the people, or they were students of his students. It's remarkable. He only lived to be 38. He never really did finish his work, come anywhere near finishing it, but he had this powerful influence in the Soviet Union. And then here in the United States, starting in the late 60s and the 70s with the cognitive revolution, his ideas infused kind of transforming American social learning theory to make it more constructivist. Within this framework, the social learning framework, there's an assumption that the child enters a network of social relationships, that's fundamental, that's important, that's where we begin in trying to explain development. My own personal kind of experience for this, some of you have experienced, is when a child is born, all of a sudden, there's this new person in the room, this person is for me. It was an overwhelming experience with all of my four children. That all of a sudden there they were. I'd sort of experienced them before in their mother's stomach or mother's uterus, but it was different when they were there. And instantly there was this relationship I had with each of them, and of course their mother had with each of them and their siblings after the first one. So when the child is born, they're born into a set of relationships, and you start to get to know them right away, and they start to get to know you. That set of relationships is at the core of cognitive and social development. We've talked before about the kind of circle of relationships that children are born into. There's a family, there's a neighborhood, there's a community, and there's a broader culture and society. And all of these are influencing the child's development and who the child becomes, what the child learns. In general, in the history in the U.S., it's been talked about as socialization, social learning and socialization within the social structures. This has come out of sociology and anthropology in particular, with sociology having a focus on what's called society, anthropology more of a focus on culture, which is meaning systems of societies or social groups. Within psychology and education, the dominant approach is this thing that's called social learning theory, which has been the main historical approach to socialization and diversity. Now, a lot of people think of learning theory as behaviorism, and they think of behaviorism as something negative, as something even fascist, and that's completely wrong historically. It was, in fact, a major part of the progressive social movement and democracy in the United States. The whole thing started with Pavlov, the Russian behaviorist, the man who invented or discovered conditioning around the turn of the century. That's where the analysis of learning began. Philosophically, it started even before that with pragmatic philosophy, which is mostly an American invention, with Charles Sanders Peirce, William James, John Dewey, also in Europe, Ludwig Wittgenstein, all taking a kind of pragmatic approach that knowledge is based in what we do in communities with other people. And behaviorism grew out of that, picking up conditioning as the kind of mechanism for learning, and then trying to figure out how social relationships led to conditioning initially. John Watson was the American who kind of kicked off behaviorism, made it into a big deal, trying to teach parents how to raise better children through behaviorism. B.F. Skinner was the more modern day proponent of that, the person who's become known as the Mr. Behaviorism. He died about 10 years ago. But Lev Vygotsky was the Russian equivalent of Watson and Skinner, but he went beyond conditioning to emphasize the constructive nature of social cognitive development. So here's a picture of Watson. Watson wrote popular books about how babies were conditioned, and was the intellectual leader of behaviorism in the United States in the first part of the 20th century. He eventually was kicked out of the field because he was caught in a illegal relationship with his research assistant. His wife was in high society in Maryland at Johns Hopkins. It was all over the front of the Baltimore's Sun, which was the most influential newspaper there at the time. And he had to resign from Johns Hopkins. And he left the field of psychology and went into advertising. He was one of the influential people in J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, which helped establish the principles of conditioning as a method of advertising. If you want to sell Pepsi-Cola, you associate it with good things. You condition people to think that Pepsi goes with being happy. And young, and energetic, and at the beach, and wealthy. That was basically a part of the legacy of behaviorism in the United States and of John Watson. Skinner took over this kind of popular side of behaviorism, having been one of the people that discovered operant conditioning. He had a strong scientific basis, and he turned to kind of making behaviorism a part of the popular ideology with very much a progressive agenda. Very clearly anti-fascism, anti-racism, against any kind of dogmatism, egalitarian, humanist, and in Skinner's case, utopian. In fact, after World War II, it was the behaviorists that led the movement to a kind of progressive social science, which was built on the proposition that people are made by their environment, by what they learn. They're not inherently or innately bad. If they become bad, if they become Nazis, for example, it's because they were made that way by their society. And that was a basic proposition of social learning theory. These days we recognize the role of biology a bit more actively, as reflected in this course. But for a long time after World War II, the learning theorists led the movement to basically say biological explanations of behavior were dangerous and people were created by their society. They weren't born to be a certain way. So that's a legacy of learning theory, of the approach that Skinner and Vygotsky embody in the U.S. and Russia, respectively. It was actually, in this country, it was called the social learning movement based on a book called Social Learning and Imitation, which John Dollard and Neil Miller wrote at Yale University. This is the precursor of what we call ecological psychology today, a focus on the environment and how it shapes us, beginning with conditioning, adding imitation to that, and observational learning. Observational learning is where you learn something by watching or listening, but you don't have to actually do it. Imitation is actually doing it. The focus was on conditioning and imitation and observational learning, and more broadly on the socialization by the family and society. On the anthropological side, the focus was on cultural differences and how they shape behavior. Here at Harvard, in human development especially, the kind of cultural anthropology side of social learning theory was born and grew. It was a combination, really, of several universities, but Harvard was one of the leading ones, with John and Beatrice Whiting as the leaders here. There's a room named after them at the top of Larson Hall, you might have noticed. A central concept for them was setting, that we shape who our children become by the kinds of settings we put them in. So, for example, in their last big study across many cultures, they found that a whole lot of sex differences between boys and girls, were not conditioned directly. Nobody taught girls to be girls. Nobody taught boys to be boys. What they did instead was to put them in settings where they did sexually stereotyped behaviors, where those were supported. So girls were put in settings where they were had to do childcare. Boys were put in settings where they had to build things or hunt. And a whole lot of cultural socialization was done through this control of settings. So this has been a very important movement. We can only do a cursory treatment of it today. We're going to focus primarily on the developmental side of it. A couple more of the important figures in the U.S. and English language psychology. Robert Sears was the founder of the Department of Human Development. He also was the kind of father of psychology, the psychology department at Stanford, which was another major center for social learning work. He and Eleanor Maccabee and some others did a major study of child rearing and how it affected personality here in Watertown and Newton. that became a model for a lot of developmental research that followed. Bandura was the West Coast leader in the last part of the 20th century of the social learning movement at Stanford. He was brought to Stanford by Sears and others. Now, in anthropology, besides the Whitings, we also have Margaret Mead, who I know everybody has heard of, since she's the kind of the most famous of all the anthropologists in popular culture. Showed how differences across cultures were really relevant to how we interpret behavior in our own culture and how we evaluate it. And she focused especially on things that we now call social roles, social norms. Actually, they were called that back then too, but for a while, people stopped talking about social roles late in the 20th century. Earlier in the 20th century, sociologists and anthropologists defined social categories and values and status, roles, norms, and status, as essential parts of culture, as a lot of how culture organizes behavior, a lot of how it socializes behavior. We've talked about roles a little bit before. Roles are categories, basically prototypes for what we're supposed to be like in certain kinds of situations, like when you're a mom or when you're a child or when you're a doctor or when you're a patient. And they're always defined in terms of role relationships, how one role relates to another, like a mom has a child, a doctor has a patient. Each role has norms associated with it, which are the kind of rules for behavior. What is a mom supposed to do? What is a child supposed to do? What is a doctor supposed to do, or a patient? And if those rules are violated, then it has at least disapproval associated with it, often moral condemnation even. How could a mother do such a thing? There's also status associated with roles. Mother role has a certain kind of status, father role has a different kind of status. Their roles associated with a child, generally lower status than adult. Their roles associated with race, with ethnicity. Their roles generally with all of the important social categories in a culture, and each of those has norms associated with it and has a certain value or status associated with it. This focus on roles was neglected in the 60s and 70s, where people thought that they could analyze who we become by just looking at learning and imitation, observational learning, processes of change, and kind of left out content, left out structure. And there was a kind of a crisis in the 60s and 70s as people were finding the explanations from learning theory to be not very satisfactory. And it all came to a head with the cognitive revolution, if you're going to talk about the mind, if you're going to talk about cognition, you had to talk about content, you had to talk about structure. Most dramatically, if you could not explain what happens with a computer, unless you talk about a program in the computer, then why can't you talk about a program in a person? Things like concepts and attention and understanding of cognitive concepts. Behavior, the extreme forms of behaviorism especially had tried to get rid of cognition, get rid of the mind, there was an awareness in the 60s and 70s that that was not possible, that we really had to take hold of the mind and try to understand it, and try to understand its social foundations. And Vygotsky played a really major role, as did Piaget, in this cognitive revolution. Vygotsky had been a behaviorist, but he had never believed that you could get rid of the mind, and had in fact talked about how social interaction and culture were essential in forming the mind. So the Vygotskyan concepts that are most important, as we are using them in the field of child development, are all centered on the idea that knowledge is transferred from one generation to another, and that there are certain processes that produce that transfer. So the broad idea is there's a kind of spontaneous apprenticeship, that we are living with experts. We're living with cultural experts, our parents, our older siblings, our aunts and uncles, our teachers, our neighbors. These are people who really know how to do the things that we have to do in our culture, in the important settings that we live in. So we spontaneously apprentice ourselves to them, to learn from them, learn by watching them, learn by acting with them. That process of doing things with other people, Vygotsky described as involving the zone of proximal development, which is a description of the variability in a child's level of activity. Children aren't simply immature at a certain stage or level, but the complexity, the sophistication of their activities move up and down all the time. And one of the primary determinants of that is the social situation, including the people that they're interacting with. We've already talked a little bit about scaffolding and social support. Those are examples of the kinds of things Vygotsky was pointing to in the zone of proximal development to say that we have to talk about a range or a zone to explain development, with the top of it being defined by children doing activities with expert adults who support them, who scaffold them. In general, adults have to tune to the child to help the child act in those settings periodically, but the child and the adult kind of grow together. Children grow through interacting with adults. In the current research in theory, there's a lot of legacy of this approach, and there are sort of two main themes in it. One is that there are social and cultural differences that we need to describe and understand. A second one is that there are specific processes of learning and development grounded in social interaction. And we're going to talk about two phenomena about these processes, as well as one phenomena about culture. The phenomena about the processes are developmental range, which is a part of the zone of proximal development, and the joint construction of knowledge in micro-development in real time as we solve problems together. You'll remember scaffolding, where an expert and a novice do a task together, with the expert, often the parent, helping the child actually do the task. So they're doing it as a joint enterprise. And these among the examples we had were this example of building blocks, putting together complicated blocks to build a pyramid. We also talked about social interactions between mother and infant, doing all kinds of tasks where the infant assumes the mother's scaffolding. Developmental range is a kind of piece of that whole social support process, different from scaffolding, but related to it, where the level of a child's activity is moving up and down from optimal to functional level, depending on whether there's contextual support for it, usually provided by another person. So with high support, they function in a sophisticated way. With lower support, they function in a more primitive way. The kind of idealized model for how this develops is that during childhood, optimal level is increasing in fits and starts, showing spurts at certain ages, whereas functional level is developing more continuously and more slowly and at a lower level. That's the developmental range. We did a study, Elaine Rotenberg and I, to unpack this a little bit with 5 and 7 year olds, to look at how support changed their level of activity over time as they did similar tasks a number of times, and also whether we could teach them to through something called self-instruction to function at a high level on their own. So part of the one of the main questions here was, with this difference between optimal and functional level that we've been talking about in the course, can you get rid of it by teaching people to support themselves, or does the context really have to provide the support in order to produce the optimal level functioning? I'm going to show you the graph for 7 year olds from this study, where they've already been doing the task for about half an hour. The task is the nice mean stories that you've already read about and we've talked about in class. After half an hour of doing both high support and low support conditions, towards the end of the session, we're showing you the graphs for what happened to these children, 8 7-year-olds with high support and low support. You'll see the first point is an imitation condition, a high support condition, where they're shown a good story, a story about nice and mean, and then they have to make up a story like that on their own. Then they're asked to just make up stories on their own without being any being demonstrated to them in the free play, low support condition. Then the experimenter comes back to the table and says, now show me the best story you can, but does no prompting to provide support. Then the experimenter provides prompts, not showing the story, but giving the gist of the story. Like, show me the story where Seth was mean to Jason because Jason had been mean to him. The gist. Again, that's a high support, and then back to a couple of low support assessments. And you'll see every child showed this pattern. With high support, they function at a high level. As soon as that support dissipates and they're doing stories without any support, they're functioning at a much lower level, about the same level across different low support conditions. They reinstitute high support in a different way, jumps right up again, take it away again, falls right back down again. This is what we find over and over and over. You can't simply teach people in an hour how to function at a high level. They actually require the high support to show the high level understanding. We also had the instruction condition that I mentioned, where the red line is the condition where we taught them to self-instruct. We had the control condition, the blue line, where they practiced the tasks and they discussed what they had done, but there wasn't an explicit instruction. You see that the only effect was, there were no statistically significant effects, but to the extent that there was any effect, it was that it helped the high support get even better. It had little or no effect on the low support. So it did not get rid of the gap between the high support and the low support to have self-instruction. In fact, the gap is actually larger for the red self-instruction than it is for the blue no self-instruction. So this gap between optimal and functional level is very basic, fundamental, pervasive, replicable. You can go out and do it yourself with kids that you know. You can do it with yourself by trying to understand something new, like something we're doing in this class, talking to one of your helpful TFs, showing a high level understanding when they're supporting your understanding, and then going away from them and having your understanding plummet without the support of a person or a text that provides the gist that you need to understand the complicated concepts. So we have no single competence, even for one domain. This is a basic message of social learning theory that's been around for a long time. This documents it quite powerfully, that we are differentially competent depending upon the kind of social context we're in. We're much smarter when we're with somebody who's helping us understand than we are when we're by ourselves trying to understand. One of the processes that goes on in building new skills is what we call micro-development, where people in real time build up skills, understandings, concepts, activities, and in order to have a better skill. We all do this in class as we're trying to learn concepts. We all do it when we're trying to solve a puzzle, work on a problem with a friend. In many different situations, we build actions into representations and representations into abstractions, and we hope that those high-level understandings that we get are going to be stable, that we'll be able to use them again. So one of the things that a lot of people are doing right now is trying to understand the process by which that occurs. There's actually a new book just coming out with Cambridge University Press, edited by Neera Granat and James Parzial, listed at the top there, that brings virtually all of the micro-developmental work together in one place from laboratories all over the world. Generally, new learning involves moving down to a low level, so you encounter a new task, Now you want to try to understand what epigenesis is and how it occurs. Or you want to understand how brain functioning contributes to emotional behavior. Or you want to understand how to build a bridge. One of the tasks that Jim Parziali uses is how to build a bridge out of marshmallows and toothpicks, which is a challenge. When people encounter these kinds of knowledge situations, we naturally regress, move down to a low level, and then have to build up our skill again. That process actually looks a lot like the long-term changes in cognitive development over many months and years. Except that it's not stable when it's first being constructed. So a person moves down to a low level in a new situation, and they build up the skill again, as you see in the first bump there. I mean, not again. They build up the skill. And then if it plummets back down again with some small change in the situation, they build it up again, and then it plummets back down again. We call this scalloping. The skill complexity increases. You might say, oh, now they've got it. But as soon as some little thing happens, it falls apart. It's not generalizable. It can't be sustained, except in the particular little situation that's there right now. This is a basic part of learning. So a basic part of building higher level skills is to do construct the understanding over and over with variations. This can be called regression. We're going to show how this happens with Lego robots, with the dyads, actually graduate students from Harvard and MIT, trying to figure out about Lego robots. Now, Lego robots are now in the stores. When this was first done, they were still being created over at MIT, and so nobody had ever seen them before, and they were in a room together trying to figure them out. What they did was, what they showed was that they had to go down to a very low level of understanding with these novel objects, starting out acting in many ways like babies and building up from actions to representations and eventually, in a few cases, to abstract understanding of these robots. Here's a little diagram of something like the robots. You'll see they have wheels for moving. They have sensors at both ends. The one on the left is for light. The one on the right is for touch. There are also sensors for sound on some of the robots. The robots move, and when one of the sensors is activated, like in this case light, it leads it to change direction or to do some other change in its movement. Then it moves back. The dyads that were working with these robots were trying to figure out how they functioned. They didn't know any of this stuff about the nature of the robot. This was their first exposure to them. They weren't told anything except go in and play with those things and try to figure them out. So they had to construct an understanding, for example, that for the Woggle, as we called it, the Lego robot that we just showed you, the Woggle moves to light. So here we've got on the left here a diagram for what they were doing. They were building it up an understanding. At the top diagram, they finally understand that the Woggle has the property that it moves to light. But they start out with lower level action understandings, sensory motor understandings, that are much more primitive than being able to represent the Woggle's properties. They start out, as we show in this diagram, understanding very simply stuff like a baby, that they see the Woggle move. Or understanding in a little more sophisticated step that when they see the light touch the Woggle, then the Woggle changes its movement or moves in a certain way. So it's they're literally understanding it in terms of what they do to the robot. A whole lot of our primitive understanding is like this. And we can even talk about it, and in our language, which might seem sophisticated, demonstrate the primitiveness of our understanding. There's an example I love that Michael Mascolo pointed out to me This is a college student. She's trying to describe how a radio works. Okay, she says, the radio, the machine, is composed of many different parts, such as the frequency setting, the volume setting, the antenna to catch the sound waves, the tuning dial, all of which work together to produce the end result, which is sound or music generating from the radio. And she's doing it entirely in terms of what she does to the radio, not in terms of how the radio works, right? She turns the dial, the tuning dial. She turns the volume setting or the frequency setting. And sure, those affect what the radio does, but what the radio really is what's inside it. And those are just ways of regulating it. A whole lot of our understanding is like that in terms of the activities rather than in terms of the basic mechanisms. So even as we walk around pretending that we're sophisticated adults, there are many things that we understand in a very primitive way in terms of activities that we do. Ann and Donald are one dyad that were doing the Lego robots that demonstrated this process of kind of building up from activities to try to understand that the Lego robot responds to light or responds to sound, whatever it's responding to for your particular robot. This is the first set of interchanges where Ann and Donald are working beautifully together trying to understand their robot. Started out with a very low-level primitive sensory motor actions, like they just saw the robot move and they had no idea really what was going on. They said very confused things, kind of mixing up what they were doing with what the robot was doing, not even differentiating their own actions from the robot's actions, like a baby with simple sensory motor actions. They built it up gradually, and then at one point here they actually took a rapid leap. That's unusual. But and when rapid leaps like that occur, it's hard to sustain them, even harder than normal. So you'll see they build up to a mapping towards the system there, and then jumped up together to a representation of what the Woggle was actually doing in the Woggle's terms instead of in terms of their own actions. But they couldn't sustain that. It fell back down again. And then over a number more interchanges, they gradually came back to being able to represent the Woggle as responding to a particular stimulus. Now, you see this, it looks like maybe that stability there. There's not nearly so much jumping around towards the end here as there is in the middle. So maybe you think, maybe now they've got it, right? But what happens is that it falls apart very quickly. It's not stable. Just a little change, and their behavior falls right back down again to a very primitive level. Whenever the task is changed, there's another regression, another backwards transition, and they have to rework and rebuild again. Here's the diagram for the whole session, where there are about 150 interchanges, when you look at the whole session, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of progress. At the end, they're right back down way low again. But what was going on was that every time there was a change in the situation, their behavior would drop back down again, and they would have to build up. When you look at those changes, marked by the red lines here, you can see that there's good progression until there's one of those changes. So they start out, they build up, as we showed you in the previous graph. Then a wire falls out of the gadget. They have to put it back in again. They put it in a different hole. They don't know they're doing that. It works differently. Their understanding is very primitive again. They're very confused. They don't know what's going on. They start confusing what they're doing with what the object is doing. And they have to build up again to understand the properties of the object until eventually they get up to a very high level understanding, quite a bit higher than in the first session, at least some of the time, moving towards even abstractions, very high level representations. And then what happens? Somebody comes in and asks them what they're doing. just a very simple thing, but now they have to summarize it in words. Their summaries are very primitive initially, and it takes them about 5 minutes or so to build up to a more sophisticated description of what they're doing. Then somebody takes out the wire again. This time they do it on purpose, put it back in, and again they're very confused. And they start building up, and then the session ends before they get up to very high level. So you have four separate episodes. In each one of them, you're seeing systematic construction of a higher level understanding, but it's not stable. It can't be sustained if there's any change in the situation. Even though these were smart Harvard and MIT graduate students like you all. Now, that kind of repeated scalloping occurs across a number of our studies. A different study done by Cheng Yan, who was a graduate student that just graduated here, is now teaching at SUNY Albany in New York. He looked at students taking H12, learning how to use a computer to program SAS to do simple statistical calculations over four sessions. I'm going to show you one session, for the first session, for a few of the students. There's a lot of specifics about this. If you want to know what it looks like, you can read his dissertation, which is in Gutman Library, or talk to us about it. The students varied widely in experience, as you know from knowing yourself and your classmates, from people who were real experts who had worked for computer companies for several years to people who had very little experience with computers and really didn't like them very much. what they showed was the scalloping, especially for people with intermediate experience. So here's one student who had intermediate experience with the computer, knew a little bit about it, but wasn't a super expert. And you'll see the performance goes up and down and up and down, showing scallops a lot like we saw before. In this particular session, I believe she was trying to get the SAS to calculate a mean of a set of data. She would move up to a high level, but then fall down again consistently. This is typical of people who have come in with intermediate levels of skill. Now, the red arrows show where the teaching fellow provided support. At each of those points, the person was confused, sometimes asked a question, and the teaching fellow provided some hints or some help. You'll see that for most of those, that led to a rise in performance. Most of those go with a high level. The support was provided, and then the person's performance jumped up to a higher level or sustained a high level. In this process where you might think about it's just a person sitting there at the computer doing their own thing, not having anybody directly support them, but in fact the teaching fellow provided a major role and probably produced some of the scalloping effect by providing support, which helped the person to understand better, but she wasn't able to sustain it. So eventually her understanding fell down to a lower level again. Now, there were some experts in the class, really remarkable experts, people who, for example, had worked for one of the big computer companies for several years and had degrees in electronic engineering, things like that. So here we have an example of one of those. You'll see he still sometimes does poorly, functions at a low level, makes a mistake, gets confused. But most of the time, remains at a high level in doing this task. So even when we know what's going on, once in a while we mess up when we're doing something that's a little different from what we usually do. But we can sustain high levels of functioning for a long time. But now, I'm calling these high levels. If you remember back to readings and classes about levels, this level 6 is only equivalent to what Piaget calls concrete operations, representational systems. So these aren't even abstractions. This person, who was capable of doing complicated work in electronic engineering or programming, never even showed a single abstraction in this task. Because it wasn't required. He just had to sit there at the keyboard and get the computer to do things to make events happen on the screen. So in general, a general point that's coming out of this research is that we should not think about people as typically functioning at their optimal level or even at their functional level. In other words, they seldom do the best they can do. Most of the time, we just do what the situation requires. And most situations, when we're not being tested by cognitive scientists who are trying to push us, don't require very sophisticated behavior. It doesn't require very sophisticated behavior most of the time to drive your car down the street, to walk across the street, to get your computer, to do some simple operations, to write words on a piece of paper, to talk to your neighbor. Mostly, you don't have to function with sophisticated, high-level cognition, only with basic, concrete systems like this. A key factor in all of this, I hope you'll see, in this micro-developmental process, is the social factor. How other people contribute to what we understand, and how people construct understanding jointly together. You can see that in the first study with the Wuggles, where it was dyads working on the robots. In the second study of the graduate students doing SAS, the statistics package, you can see it because there was a teaching fellow there that was providing support when it was needed. Think more broadly for a minute, the way Vygotsky would think. The computer is a human construction designed to support our activity. The chair, the table, the pencil, the language, the written language, all of these things are tools that we have created to support our own activities. So you need to think about support more broadly than just other people actually interacting with you. You need to think about it in terms of machines and tools and objects that we create to support our own activity. In fact, most of the time, walking around, we're only in human environments that have been constructed by human beings for other human beings. So most of the time, we're not even dealing with nature in the raw. We're dealing with things that we have constructed to support our own activities, and in many cases to support more complex, more sophisticated activities that our society needs. Also, we try to figure out how to support our own behavior. One of the things that we get good at, if we do well in school, I think, there haven't been many studies of this, is that we can support our own, we can scaffold ourselves. So, like, if I want to do a skill analysis, here's an activity, what kind of skill does this show? Well, I'm an expert at that, but still, in order to do it, I do things like I draw diagrams to support my own understanding of what's going on. And I can think in a much more sophisticated way with the diagrams than without them. A whole lot of what we do is like that. We write things down, we draw things, we learn images that we recall in our minds that help us to have a more sophisticated understanding. So sometimes we can support ourselves, we can scaffold ourselves. There haven't been many studies of that process. We need to have more of them. Mary Helen Mordino Yang, who some of you might know, did one nice little study of this using tapes of people who were practicing the piano. And she found that some of them would occasionally talk to themselves in intelligent ways about what they were playing. And right about that time, they would show improvement in their performance. It wouldn't last for a long time. It would just last for a little while. But they could actually sometimes talk to themselves and apparently support their own piano playing, so they got a little bit more sophisticated. We think this kind of process goes on a lot, and it's something that really needs to be studied. If anybody's looking for a good research topic, this is a great one, in my opinion. Now, that's the kind of micro process by which we construct understanding. The other focus for Vygotsky and for social learning theory is the broad cultural societal effects, where we have societal structures like roles and norms and status that we talked about before, which teach us how we're supposed to act. And in those roles, there are many strengths. If you've learned the role for being in a restaurant, you know what to do when you're in a restaurant. If you don't know that role for your particular society, you can be very embarrassed when you go to a restaurant. You can even have trouble getting food. There are a whole bunch of roles like that, and we learn thousands of them, and we become quite good at many of them. But along with that, they also bring, along with those virtues, they also bring negative characteristics. Roles and cognitive structures in general have hidden properties that we may not even be aware of. The most blatant one is probably, certainly one of the most blatant, is stereotyping. It's really evident in racism, sexism, ethnocentrism, where we pick up categories from the culture and we don't even know that we've done it most of the time. And then we act in ways that really are unfair and unjust to other people. This is particularly a problem because it's really bad for those other people. It can create bad lives for them. It can put their lives in danger. Even when their lives aren't in danger, it has an effect on what they do, on how competent they are. The stigmas that go with it. There's a bunch of research now. The best known person in this arena is Claude Steele, who's at the Stanford University. Harvard tried to steal him away, but he decided not to come. He followed up on some earlier work showing that with children in classrooms, if you stigmatize them in some way, like, you know, in our culture, you're black, you're not as good as the whites. Or you're a girl, you're not as smart as the boys. In more contrived situations, you have an armband on, so you're one of the bad ones. Just doing arbitrary stereotyping like that, or stigmatizing like that, leads to a drop in performance. So kids who have been stigmatized don't do as well in a vocabulary test as the kids who haven't been stigmatized. Just in a matter of minutes, you can cause a drop in performance by stigmatizing a child. Very powerful effect, very relevant to school assessments. Now, there's a broader effect which can involve life and death, which is demonstrated really nicely in the paper by Chandler and Lalonde, which you all are reading. They looked at Canadian native peoples in British Columbia. There are a lot of different native groups there, there's a general belief in Canada, as there is in the United States, that native peoples are much more likely to commit suicide. They studied that, and they showed that the kind of proactive role that a particular cultural group, a particular tribe, took in its in the life of its citizens, had a powerful effect on the suicide rate. So, in general, if you just look across all of the native groups, they have a higher suicide rate than normal. If you look at this graph, the lower dotted line is the average suicide rate for Canadians. You'll see it's way below many of the blue line groups, which are the First Nations, as they're called. But if you look more carefully, you see that many of these First Nations groups have very low suicide rates. In fact, how many is it? 7 or 8 of them have no suicides in the time recorded. So that there's a lot of variability there. And their hypothesis was that sort of taking control of your cultural life, empowering yourselves as a cultural group, that is the most important factor, one of the most important factors for lowering suicide. Giving people a meaningful life might be another way of saying it. So if you look at some of the results here, which you're also reading, the groups that were that were involved in self-government, the label is backwards. I'm sorry. the group that was involved in self-government, that's the taller group, I guess you won't see. I'll fix it before it comes on the tape. So so forget what I said about the label. The high bars show the high suicide rates for the groups that were not involved in self-government, not involved in making claims for land. The lower bars, the blue ones, show low suicide rates, very low, for the groups that were self-governing, and that were making claims to try to reclaim land that had been taken from them by the Canadian government or historical antecedents of the Canadian government. So that's a very powerful effect, and it shows how these cultural effects are not just something that we talk about in Larson Hall or in universities, that they really affect people's lives at the very core, even whether they want to stay alive or not. So social learning theory deals with these kinds of phenomena, kind of how we come to be who we are, how that's affected by our interactions with other people, especially the people that are close to us, and how that's affected by the culture and society that we live in. This general approach was formulated jointly in the U.S. and Russia, even though the U.S. and Russia have historically been enemies. The approach was very much jointly constructed by scholars and intellectual leaders in the two countries. Vygotsky has become the premier leader among all the leaders of the social learning movement, because he really put together social influences with the idea that we build our activities, we build our skills, we build our minds, we build ourselves and others. With the central ideas of zone of proximal development, scaffolding, and other more recent ideas derived from Vygotsky and others about how social support affects development and learning. Microdevelopment is a kind of recent focus of research. There was only a little bit done during Vygotsky's time, but now it's becoming a major topic, as I tried to illustrate, analyzing the actual real-time processes of how we construct skills with other people. The influence of culture, something we will come back to in later sessions, is powerful as described by social learning theory and is documented by studies like the one of the Canadian Native peoples. It's adaptive to have a positive ethnic identification, positive racial and gender identification, generally a positive view of ourselves, but our cultures sometimes make that difficult. And that's one of the insights that comes from the social learning approach.